Kol lo shel dover. The rule of the matter is, Ha'adam lo nivra bavur, matzavo b'olam hazeh. Man was not created for his station in this world. Ela bavur matzavo b'olam haba, but rather he was created for his station in the world to come. Ela shematzavo b'olam hazeh, but his position in this world, hu emtsai, is a medium, a vehicle to attain. L'matzavo b'olam haba, to get to his position in the world to come, shu tachliso, which is his purpose. Imagine for a moment that the Torah said to you, you have to live on an austere, difficult life. Your role in this world is to suffer tremendous poverty, be a hermit, seclude yourself from every enjoyment and every pleasurable activity. Now, if that was what the Torah was to tell us to do, a wise person would say, it's worth it. Listen, I'll suffer for X amount of years here, and then for eternity, I'll gain my world to come. My Olam Haba, which is forever and ever, is so great. The pleasure there is so wonderful that it's worth suffering a good number of years here so that for eternity, forever, I'll enjoy. But interestingly enough, that's not at all what the Torah commands us in, and not at all the Torah's perspective. I'd like to offer a very interesting contention, and that is that if a person lives a proper Torah lifestyle, they'll have more pleasure, more benefit in this world than they would otherwise. And astonishingly, that's not the normal thought process you hear from most people, especially young yeshiva students. Oh, if only I could be a guy. Oh, what pleasure I would have. Freedom, do what I want, when I want, and it would be so pleasurable. And I'd like to focus on that contention. That contention that if I didn't have the Torah's burden upon me, if I didn't have these rules and restrictions, I would have so much pleasure, but nebuch, I'm restricted by the Torah, and therefore I can't enjoy myself. I'd like to offer to you the fact that that is the opposite of reality. And let's spend a few minutes on understanding why it is that people typically make that mistake, and what is the basis for that error. Now let's start with the following. There are some basic concepts that need definition. There is a concept called pleasure, and there is a concept called passion, or taiva. And those two aren't the same. Let me give you a for instance. Let's imagine for a minute you're on a ocean cruise, and somehow the boat goes down, and you find yourself shipwrecked on a deserted island. You haven't eaten in 3 days, you're parched, you're starving. You see by a coconut tree over there somewhere a brown paper bag. And you open the brown paper bag, and inside it you see a peanut butter sandwich. Dry, brittle, it's been sitting in the sun baking for 6 months, but you're famished. You're so hungry that you wolf it down faster than you even realize it. Here's the question. How much pleasure did you have in that activity? How much benefit, how much enjoyment did you have? Do you think for the rest of your life you're going to remember, oh, the delicious taste of the acrid burning peanut butter as it kind of rubbed against my throat? There was very, very little pleasure in that activity, but there was a lot of passion. You were very hungry. You had a very real appetite for that. Passion, desire, taiva, is a pull towards doing something. Pleasure is the amount of benefit, the sensation of enjoyment that you have when you do that activity. And oftentimes we confuse the two, as in if I have a great passion for something, if I have a great appetite for something, oh, it must be so pleasurable. So obviously, if the Torah restricts my appetites and restricts my desires, obviously the Torah is stopping my fun. But I think if we look at things, we'll quickly see that there are many things that a person could have tremendous desires for, but aren't much fun. Let's take something called addiction. Speak to someone who's addicted, whether it be to pills, whether it be to alcohol, whether it be to whatever, and ask them to describe how much pleasure they have in the activity. Now, initially, the first time that they got high or drunk or whatever it may be, it was great, it was awesome, it was unbelievable. But now that they're addicted, ask them to describe what's happening. You'll hear expressions like chained to the bottle, having to take another drink despite the fact that I wish I didn't ever begin, knowing that the next drink may kill me, but not being able to stop myself. the expression of an addict are not expressions of pleasure. They're pulled very, very powerfully. There's a tremendous need to do that given activity, but the pleasure often is long gone. Passion, desire is a pull. Pleasure is not always the correlate. Pleasure is the benefit, taiva is the pull. And when you learn to tease those two apart, what you quickly see is that that which we have desires for is not always the most pleasurable thing we have. The Torah is interested and wants us to enjoy and have pleasure, but to control appetites. And I'd like to share with you a concept that I think is very, very compelling. In the United States of America, there's a tremendous understanding. It seems to be a cultural given that all I need to solve all of life's problems is a little bit more money. Oh, if I only had $10 million more, my Shalom Bias problems would disappear. My kids being annoying and bratty, just go away. All of my issues from acne to emotional problems to health problems would all disappear with just a little bit more money. So for the fun of it, let's play out the American dream. Let's imagine for a minute that I win the lotto, but not a little lotto, I win big. $365 million, the largest single cash payout in the history of the lottery. Now remember, I've known all my life that all that's standing between me and some real, real pleasure is money, and now I've won it, I've arrived, I'm there, and I set out to have as much pleasure as I possibly can. So here's my plan. I will now, from this moment forward, enjoy myself. I will set my goal as absolute attainment of pleasure. All that's been stopping me is my lack of money. Now I got that money, let's go. Okay, so what do? Best way to start is by buying a small island in the southern Pacific over there, a very, very beautiful tropical place. I hire myself an entire team of butlers and maids, of course only my personal chefs, Mediterranean cuisine for breakfast, Italian for lunch, my personal French chef for dinner, because no amount of money is too great for my pleasure, and I set out on my hedonistic acquisition of pleasure crusade. Okay, so I plan it out. The first evening's dinner is exquisite, a thick steak, but so soft you could cut it with a butter knife. The most exquisite flavors and aromas. My white-gloved waiter pulls out the chair as I sit down to my ornate dining room table. They bring covered my inch-thick steak, lay it down on the table in front of me, and I cut into it and I take the first bite. The pleasure, the flavors, the aromas, the texture of it is so wondrous. The second bite, the third bite, and by the fourth bite, I'm distracted, my mind has wandered, and I'm somewhere else. And I continue eating, and I continue eating, and I wake up somewhere at the end of that steak, and oh my goodness, my steak, the thickness, the butter, where'd it go? And I discover the first rule of pleasure. The first rule of pleasure is that the sizzle is better than the steak. You ever notice when they do the ads for the steakhouse, you see the piece of meat go on the griddle and tss. They don't just put the meat in front of you, you hear the tss because the sizzle sells the steak. And the first rule of pleasure is that the hype is always better than the pleasure itself. The sizzle is far better than the steak. Every pleasure you'll find on this planet is overpromised and underdelivered. It's gonna be great. It's gonna be unbelievable. The unbelievable pleasure, heaps and heaps, piles of piles. I mean, it's unreal. Just read some Madison Avenue ad copy and you see the descriptions of unending pleasure, of astonishing pleasure, and you realize that they're selling soap, shampoos, and razor blades. And what you begin to understand is that every pleasure is oversold, underdelivered, the sizzle is far greater than the steak, and I've just learned the first rule of pleasure, that first rule of pleasure is that it's always the hype. It always sounds so phenomenal, and it sounds better than it is. And if you're not sure that I'm right, I'll give you an interesting illustration. Do you know the difference between a genuine Rolex and a fake? Now, the price difference could be pretty steep. You could pick up a knockoff copy of a Rolex for $100. You could buy a genuine Rolex anywhere from $3,000 to $18,000. But what's the difference? How do you tell whether it's a real or it's a knockoff? So I'd like to share with you the way you can tell. If you take the face of the Rolex and you watch the movement of the second hand, you see if it jumps, that's a genuine Rolex. Why? Because the mechanism is sophisticated. It's an advanced mechanism, and it has that jumping movement. If it's smooth, then you know that it's a knockoff. Now, I want you to think about this. On my hand, I wear a Timex $29 watch. This watch is accurate to within a hundredth of a second for years. You will not find a Rolex on the planet that's anywhere near as accurate as my Timex $29 watch. And you will not tell me for a minute that your Rolex is half as sophisticated. I have a chronograph. Mine tells me which direction to daven mincha in. Mine is crafted for exquisite time telling. Your Rolex that you spend $10,000 or $18,000 has a jumpy hand. Tick, 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 tick. My watch tells time much better. And this is the American dream. See it, desire it, borrow for it, and then buy it. And your soul's dream of, if I could only have it, if I could only get it, then wow, life is going to be so wondrous. And you finally borrow enough money, you finally acquire it, and you learn the first rule of pleasure. The hype is unbelievable. The sizzle is great. The steak is okay. But it's far less than what was promised. It's always under-delivered. But listen, I am a major big deal hedonist. I've waited my whole life for this pleasure crusade, and I'm not going to allow one rule of pleasure to stop me. I've got my money, I've got my private island, I've got my host of servants. I am going to head along my path of absolute acquisition of pleasure. So I continue, and I plan out my days, and I plan out my nights, and everything is there for me to just enjoy. I sit down the second evening to my undescribable, delicious steak, and I discover another interesting rule. As I bite into that steak, and I consume it, and I consume it, and I eat, I find that there's a certain point that I'm sated, and I have to stop. You see, I ate that steak with real gusto, and I trained myself to not just pay attention to bite 1, 2, 3, and 4. I continue to pay attention, and I really luxuriated in the flavors, the aromas, the textures. I was enjoying the steak to the utmost. But after a while, I'm full, and I can't eat anymore. And I discover the second rule of pleasure, and that is that every pleasure has a limit. It might be 10 minutes. It may be 20 minutes, maybe it's one steak, maybe it's two, but then I'm full and I can't eat anymore. Oh, I could try to cram some more in, I could try, but every pleasure, no matter how great it is, no matter how wondrous it sounds, has a limit. The first rule of pleasures is that the salesmanship is always better than the pleasure itself. And the second rule of pleasure is that every pleasure, no matter how great it is, no matter how much they sell it, has a limit. If it's eating, it's for 10 minutes, it's for 20 minutes, if it's going on a tour, whatever your pleasures are, have a limit, and once you're done, you're finished, and the pleasure's gone. And I begin to realize quickly that all of my money, and even my private island, aren't really delivering that which I dreamt of, that which I wished to really enjoy. And if you're not sure that my point is well made, I'll share with you an interesting statistic. 80% of major lottery winners, these are people who won tremendous sums of money. They no longer had to work. They no longer had to worry about anything. 80% of major lottery winners are back at work within 1 year of their winning. Within 1 year of their hitting the jackpot and never having to worry about money again, they're back at work, often at the same job that they left. And that's astonishing. I want you to imagine you have Joe, the UPS driver. He's driving every day, picking up those packages, putting them down, brown socks, brown shorts. He's there every day, all day. And every day you hear him say, oh, just one winning. Man, just one lotto and I'm out of here. You'll never see me again. No brown socks for Joe, not me. I'll be out of this joint and you'll never see me again. And for 10 years, he's going on that rant again and again, day after day. And then finally he wins. He wins and he wins big. And what happens? He retires, quits his job. And he buys a BMW in every flavor in the rainbow. And he goes on a world tour. And after 8 months or 9 months, he finds himself bored and he's back at the same job that he left. But Joe, what's the deal? You're the guy who said, just get me a little money and I'm out of here. But Joe discovered something interesting. Pleasures are interesting. Pleasures are significant. But I'm just, I just can't do it all day. The hype is cute, but I got the pleasure and now what? I'm empty. I'm devoid, and what do I do now? But wait, folks, I am not a quitter. I am on my chase of hedonism. I am on my pleasure excursion, and I will not be put off by a couple of rules of pleasure, and I set out to really enjoy life. I plan my days. It's going to be bungee cord jumping off the Eiffel Tower. It's going to be flying a balloon, hot air balloon over the Serengeti. I'm planning my joy and satisfaction. I am going to truly enjoy life. And I set out to do just that. And then I discover the third rule of pleasure. You ever go to a restaurant and you have your fantastic favorite meal? And you just know it. You've had it before and it's just the most delicious thing in the world. And you come back to that same restaurant and something's missing. I don't know what it is. I mean, I ate this before, the same restaurant, same cook, but last time it just tasted better. I don't understand, but it's the same cook, same dish, same. Why did it taste so much better then than now? And you discover the third rule of pleasure. The third rule of pleasure is the first time is the best time, but there's only one first time. I was a young man. We were recently married, and I was still in Kollel. I was a Rebbe, kind of on the side. We were living in Rochester, and houses were very inexpensive. It ended up financially to be more practical for us to purchase a home than it was to pay rent. So we bought a small home. And there I was, a young man, standing outside of this house, and I felt like the richest guy in the world. I owned a home. The house I now live in is three times as large as that house. The house I live in now is way more expensive than the house there. But I don't think I could ever replicate that feeling of wealth, of being an usher. Do you know what a wealthy guy I am? I own a home. You see, the first time is astonishing. The first time is unbelievable. But there's only one first time. And that's the third rule of pleasure. The third rule of pleasure is the first time is the best time, but there's only one first time. And you could try, and you could dream, and you could think that you're going to fool the system, but the truth is that people try it again and again, and they find themselves as empty and lacking as before. But I am not a quitter, and I am going to continue, and I will not give up because of three silly rules of pleasure. I'm going to have pleasure. So I set out and really, really set my goal to acquire pleasure. And I'd like to share with you the fourth rule of pleasure. You ever listen to someone who comes back from an exotic vacation? Whoa, it was a safari out in the deep African plains over there. Listen to their description. We had such a fantastic time. It was great. I really enjoyed myself. Do you ever notice that all of the expressions are in the past tense? As in, I had a great time. I enjoyed myself. It was amazing. And the fourth rule of pleasure is that once the pleasure's gone, there's nothing left. I had a great time. It was amazing. but all that I have now is a sunburn and $3,000 of credit card debt. But the pleasure, once you've had it, is gone. And once you've done the thing, there's nothing left. And I begin to discover the great secret of being a human being. And that is that the average person thinks that he's smarter than the average person. You ever hear that expression? Well, I'll explain to you what it means. Everyone knows that money can't buy happiness. Everyone knows that. That's a given. Money can't buy happiness. Except me. I know that money can't buy happiness because that's because people don't know what to buy with it. But if you were smart as me and you had some money, believe me, I could buy happiness. And astonishingly, everyone has this delusional state that yes, money doesn't buy happiness, but just give me a couple of million, give me 10, 20, 40 million, I'll be as happy as a lark. And person after person falls for the nonsense, falls for the delusional state, and they live their life in this dream state, pursuing their goals of pleasure, and they never find it. Why? Because Hashem did not create the human being as a tool for the acquisition of pleasure. Do pleasures have a purpose? Oh, yes, they do. The Mesil Hasharim explains to us exactly their purpose. They are a tool. They're a tool to be used. Hashem wants us to enjoy this world. It's not the reason we're here. But pleasures, enjoyments, benefits are things that we're supposed to take to help us better serve our Creator, to help us better serve our purpose in the world. Hashem designed that orange. Hashem designed that pear. Hashem designed the red of the apple, the cellular walls to be hard so that when I bite in, I get that crunch. The peel of the orange to have those very small micro sacs of scent so I should enjoy it because Hashem wants me to enjoy it. And the goal of a thinking person is to use these pleasures, but to understand that pleasures have a purpose. If I set my goal in life to be a hedonist, to be a pleasure seeker, as in, wow, let's acquire as much pleasure as I can, what I find is that the human being was poorly designed for that purpose. And when you use a fine surgical tool to pry open a window, it does a lousy job and it ruins the blade. You see, when you use a human being, a life, for the strict goal of acquiring pleasure, what you find is it doesn't work. But there's a reason why it doesn't work, because it's not what your Creator made you for. And the four rules of pleasure are universal. No matter what you're going to believe, the hype is great, it sounds wondrous, it sounds wow, but it's always oversold. There's a limit to every pleasure. No matter how much pleasure you have, it's always going to be in the past tense. But more than anything, no matter what, the pleasures will leave you empty and vacuous if that's your goal in life. If you use pleasures appropriately, you enjoy them, you benefit from them, but you use them as tools. As a very small example, I remember there was a fellow in yeshiva who was a tremendous masmid, a very well worked out fellow, and he was once by the candy machine and eating a chocolate bar. And it looked a little unusual because he was very health conscious, and it sort of like, what's going on? What was going on was he needed a break. So he took a chocolate bar as his break. But you understand what I'm saying? He used that as a tool, as a vehicle to help him. He needed a break, he needed a certain yeshiva das, says the Mesil Hasharim, that is the purpose of pleasures. Should you enjoy this life 100%, take the pleasures, but use them. Hashem designed them, Hashem wants us to use them, but use them as tools, use them as vehicles, use them very guardedly and very carefully. And then a very funny thing happens. You actually enjoy them, because they were made to be enjoyed in context, in proper use. They were made for that purpose, and when you use it in that way, they serve a very real benefit, and you actually enjoy them. And if you sincerely are setting your goal as the acquisition of pleasure, I have a word of advice for you. Use the Torah's lifestyle. And what the Torah says is, Hashem created us to grow and accomplish, and if you use your time here in a way as you should, and use the benefits of this world appropriately, you will have far more pleasure, far more enjoyment, because that's what Hashem created these things for, and Hashem created you to use them appropriately. And as astonishing as it sounds, when a person dedicates himself to a Torah lifestyle, they enjoy, they have a tremendous, beautiful life not needless to say, the world to come in this world here. And I want to just share one interesting observation. They've done a study comparing major lottery winners and paraplegics. Now, those are two vastly different life experiences. Major lottery winners are those people who won tremendous sums of money, the American dream. They've arrived. A paraplegic is, Rahman Salam, a person who lost two limbs and now has to create a vastly different life. The study analyzed happiness. How happy were the two groups? Needless to say, initially, there was a stark difference in happiness between the major lottery winners and people who became paraplegic. And people who are major lottery winners, wow, life is great. Happiness soared to the roof. People who were, Rahman al-Islam, paraplegics were very down and very depressed. But then they analyzed the same group 1 year later, and this is what they found. No difference in reported level of happiness except the groups who are now wheelchair-bound experienced greater joy in their day-to-day living than did the group of lottery winners. Now, isn't that astonishing? Isn't it absurd? All you need is money. All you need is wealth. And losing your legs is the worst thing in the world. And if it weren't for the fact that Hashem created the human being very, very carefully, and that Hashem designed everything in this world for a purpose, that would be a tema. It would be a perplexing, unanswerable question. But once you understand the human being, and once you understand pleasures have their purpose, and once you understand life, you understand them very, very differently. Pleasure is the enjoyment. Passion is the desire. The Torah wants us to use this world, to enjoy this world, but the key distinction between pleasure and passion has to be understood. But there's another distinction that's even bigger. Passion is the desire. Joy and happiness is a state of mind. If you read the billboards, if you read the ads that are put out, an unending stream of the following message: all you need to be happy is money. All you need to be happy is pleasure. All you need to be happy is materialism. And it even goes so far as they'll sell potato chips now with the tagline, "Open a bag of happiness." And as foolish as it sounds, we fall prey to it. Joy and happiness are emotional states. They're emotional states that occur to a human when the human being is in balance, when he's in sync, when I and I are in balance working together. When a human being uses his life appropriately, when he uses his time properly, there's an inner joy, there's a happiness. Pleasures do not bring happiness. Pleasures do not bring joy. Oh, they look so appealing. They look so enticing. If only. And then every human being goes through the same mistake again and again. If only I could. If only I could. They have it. They find that they made the same mistake as the person before them. The desire for the object doesn't equate to the pleasure. And the desire for the object surely does not equate to joy and happiness. And I want to close with one last observation. Last summer, I was in Ottawa, and I had a chance to meet up with a person who I knew from yeshiva days, a gentleman named Rabbi Yehuda Symes. Rabbi Yehuda Symes had spent many years in yeshiva. He then went to Ottawa to become a Rebbe in the day school. He got smicha from yeshiva, he became a Rebbe, and he was exactly that. They were a big part of the community there, and they were doing very well. Sometime about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, his family and he were driving back from Ottawa to New York. Somewhere on the highway, his wife was driving. He was in the passenger seat in the front. There was a deer in the front of the highway. She quickly swerved away. The van flipped over. Mrs. Symes describes that she got out of the van and she witnessed 8 miracles. Each one of her children got out unscathed, untouched. As a matter of fact, she was pregnant, highly pregnant. She gave birth to a full-term baby, 8 perfect miracles. Rabbi Symes was not so fortunate. He was crushed in the driver's seat. They brought an airlift in to take him out to emergency surgery. And Rahman al-San, he's in a wheelchair, and he is pretty close to a quadriplegic. Can't use his legs, basically can't use his arms. The only thing he can do, a little bit, he can maneuver the wheelchair this way with his fingers, but his life is vastly changed. Now, I hadn't seen him since the accident, and I was invited to speak in Ottawa, and I was giving a schmooze, and there was Rabbi Symes in his wheelchair. But there was something surreal about the situation. He looked good, but he didn't just look good, he looked great. Happy, with a shine, with a glow to him. Now, it was a very public situation, and I was speaking, so I couldn't really have a deep conversation with him, but I said hello, and we sort of made up to speak after. And after I was done, I went to his house, and we had a long conversation. And I got to witness his children coming over, take care of him. Are you okay? Can we help? Fixing a pillow, fixing. To his kids, he was a regular tati, a regular abba. But as we were speaking, it was clear that he was happy. It was clear we were talking and learning and talking about life and different situations and different things. And then he said to me an astonishing thing. He said, do you know that most people in my situation with a C3, C4 break, a break that high up in the spinal cord, are institutionalized. But it's not because of the mobility, not because they can't live in home. They can't live in their home because there's so much anger and so much depression that they have to spend the rest of their life in an institution. And then he looked at me and he said, I don't have any anger and I don't have any depression. And I saw something astonishing. He was a man who was living in what we would call Gehenna. He was a man who was living in about as bad a condition as you could ever envision or imagine, and he was genuinely happy. And I took it as a tremendous Musar lesson. I spent 30 years thinking about, discussing, writing about, teaching this Yesod, but here was a man who was living it, living a life of joy and happiness because he understood life, because there was an inner joy based on meaning, based on purpose. It's not what Hashem wishes for every human being, and certainly not what we daven for, but understanding that joy and happiness are things that Hashem wants us to experience, but you have to understand life, you have to understand pleasures have their purpose, pleasures have their place, but you have to fundamentally understand life. When you do, life is beautiful, life is sweet, pleasures have their purpose, and you have a balanced, happy, harmonious life.